Okay, good evening, Tuesday night Bible study. We're doing the minor prophet Micah. We're going to finish up chapter 1 and then do chapter 2 today. So last week, a couple of you that missed, I know Rich and Susan, did you find the recording? No, you couldn't. Okay, go to the website, go to the spot where the Bible study is, and then go do something for about 5 minutes and come back.
Okay.
It's a slow website.
Class.
What's that?
She came to Bible class while
loading. Oh, yeah, there you go. You're here tonight while it's loading last week,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I think if you scan on the blog, you'll find stuff faster than you go to the website.
I don't know, maybe. I just go to the website. And it does. It is slow, and Fred knows, and he hasn't gotten to fixing it or talking to the consultant or whatever. So last week we did some preliminary stuff, and then we got through verse 9 of chapter 1. Micah is giving them prophecies of judgment against both Samaria and Jerusalem. Those are the two capital cities. So that's where the problem is started and centered. You know, leadership can really impact everyone else. So, like parents in a family, whatever parents do, then the children will follow suit. Whatever, you know, pastor and church leaders do, the rest of the congregation follows suit. And the same thing in, you know, government. So that's why the prophecy of judgment from Micah starts with the leaders right there, Samaria and Jerusalem in verse 5. And one of the things that he's talking about is because of their carved images, their false worship. That's the biggest problem, the biggest sin that they're engaged in. And then we get down to verse 9 here where we finished. For her wound is incurable, and it has come to Judah. It has reached to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. So Samaria, if you remember from last week, I mentioned that Samaria had entirely bad kings. After Solomon, the north kingdom split from the southern kingdom, so Israel split into two kingdoms. And every king thereafter, in according to 1 and 2 Kings, was an evil king. Because they tolerated false worship or actually engaged in it and promoted it. The southern kings, some of them were faithful, promoted and taught faithful worship of the true God, Yahweh, in the temple at Jerusalem. And some were bad. So they kind of, it wasn't a one for one alternating, but they'd have a good king and then a bad king and then maybe a couple of good ones and then maybe a couple of bad ones like that. So Judah was not quite as bad as Samaria, but this is what he's talking about, Micah's talk about. For the wound of Samaria is incurable, and it has come to Judah, it has reached the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. So that's where we ended last week. Okay? Questions about that at all, or thoughts that have come up? All right, continuing on. Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. In Beth-la-Ephrah, roll yourselves in the dust. So first of all, why not tell it in Gath? Gath is a Philistine city. Why would you not tell it in Gath about the coming judgment upon Israel and Judah? Why would you not tell that in Gath?
They wanted the Philistines dead anyway.
Well, that might be part of it, I suppose. But some of it is that you don't want your enemies to gloat. You don't want them to cheer that you're about your downfall. Okay? So don't tell it to our enemies that God's people are doomed or, you know, being brought under judgment. So that's part of it. And then Luther himself says that there's some difficult translation issues here because he mentions a whole bunch of cities that are puns in Hebrew. And if you have the Lutheran Study Bible, you'll notice it references a whole bunch of them. Okay? So a lot of what I'm telling you, you'll find there. It's in the commentary as well. But a number of these cities no longer exist, and archaeologists don't know where they are. Some of them have been found. But it's assumed that all of these are small towns or villages kind of west and southwest of Jerusalem, which is where Micah came from. So he's using puns of town names to further comment on the coming judgment of Judah as well as Israel. So in Beth-la-Ephrah, so that means house of dust. that name of that town means house of dust. So he says, in Bethlehem Ephrah, roll yourselves in the dust. So you can see the pun there, the irony there. And why would you roll yourself in dust? Why did they do that? Why did they sit in ash in ashes with sackcloth on?
Mourning.
It was a sign of mourning. So what are they mourning over? The judgment of Israel, that Israel's been unfaithful. Okay? Pass on your way, inhabitants of Shafir. Shafir means beautiful. Can somebody read that footnote in the Lutheran Study Bible for verse 11? Go ahead, Sandy.
Means beautiful, nakedness and shame. Suggests a beautiful woman stripped and violated, being led away captive after military defeat. Go on with this.
No, that's fine. That's enough. So, yes, that's what Shafir means. So what would happen is, in the ancient world, if one king would conquer another area or territory or city, you would take the spoils. So anything valuable you take for your own, that's part of your spoils, pay for your side of the war. And anybody who's capable, you would take for slaves. Well, slaves would be stripped down to almost nothing. You know, you'd have basically loincloths or, a little bit of a cloak on. And that's on purpose, both to shame you, but also to make sure you can't hide anything. So, basically saying, Shafir, those who are beautiful but naked and captured, just pass on your way. So it's a reference to being captured and being made a slave. Then, that's why he also says they're in nakedness and shame. So pass on your way, and nakedness and shame is a reference to the pun of the name Shafir. The inhabitants of Zanan do not come out. Well, what does Zanan mean? It means get out. That's what it means in Hebrew. So, the inhabitants of the town named Get Out don't come out. Why? Why would you not come out? Because outside there's judgment coming upon you. How is God bringing judgment upon them? It's through a foreign army, the Assyrians and then the Babylonians. Okay? So what would you do if there's a foreign army coming and you're out in the countryside in an unprotected house, with your land? You hide. That's what you do. Okay? So that's that one. And then he says, the lamentation of Beth Azel shall take away from you its standing place. Well, Beth Azel means house at the side of. So standing at the side of. So the lamentation, the mourning of the city named at the side of shall take you away from its standing place. So again, you can see there's a little pun on words there. That's much more obvious if you speak Hebrew. So we all need to learn Hebrew. Okay?
That'll be next fall?
Yeah, that'll be next fall, right? We had in our Winkle today was our monthly Winkle for the pastors, and I was the host. We were right here. We had like 14 pastors here. And Pastor Roth from Trinity St. Joe brought with him a missionary from South Africa who's touring the United States to promote the mission work there. They're in fellowship. The Lutheran Church in South Africa is in fellowship with the LCMS. And this particular missionary is from Germany. He grew up in Germany. His first language is German. Then he learned English. He was ordained, and then he got a PhD, and now he's teaching at the seminary in South Africa. He made the comment, he said, well, if all of you would learn German like me, that's obviously the language of God. Rich, you know German, so you know the language of God, according to him.
Sounds like my mom. I know somebody who's a German major.
All right. Very good. Long time ago, huh? Okay, so then verse 12, for the inhabitants of Maroth, wait anxiously for good, because disaster has come down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. So what does Maroth mean? It means bitter or rebellious. So they are bitterly waiting for the disaster, the judgment that God is bringing upon them. They are bitter about it. Okay, so again, a little play on words. Verse 13, harness the steeds of the chariots, inhabitants of Lachish. It was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for in you were found the transgressions of Israel. Now, we're getting a little bit farther from the puns, okay? Lachish is a town that is known by archaeologists and a location in Israel, and Lachish was the center of Judah's military. So that's where they would house their horses and chariots, and they had barracks there for a good chunk of the military, the fighting men. They were housed in Lachish. I think, does it say in the Lutheran Study Bible how far Lachish is from Jerusalem? It's like 20 miles or something? 25 miles, yeah. So here's part of the problem, and God warns the people throughout the Old Testament era, don't trust your military. You're not supposed to build up your military. You trust me. I will take care of you. And how many times does God come to their rescue and fight the battles through some miraculous thing? Gideon has a mere 300 men and defeats thousands of the enemy. Or, you know, the sun stands still so they can finish the battle. And various things like that. God repeatedly told them, don't trust your military. That's an earthly thing. You trust me. So this is the problem that he's talking about here, that Mike is talking about. Harness the steeds to the chariots, inhabitants of Lachish, because that was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for in you were found the transgressions of Israel. One of the transgressions of Israel, in addition, the biggest one being false worship, but a second one was trusting in their own might, trusting in themselves rather than in God. And by trusting in themselves, what ended up happening? They got overrun by the Assyrians, completely demolished. And so now that attitude is creeping into Jerusalem, into Judah, because that beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, that's a reference to Jerusalem. So that's the transgression of Israel that's coming upon them. You know, I don't know if that still applies today, but I hear about how great our U.S. military is in the war in Iran and how well we've done over there. We've kind of obliterated them, and I'm like, yeah, we're powerful. Well, should I be thinking that way as a pastor? Trust in God, but, you know, we are powerful. Anyway. All right. Therefore, you shall give parting gifts to Moresheth Gath. The houses of Exeb shall be a deceitful thing to the kings of Israel. So I think, again, we have some puns here. Moresheth Gath means dowry. So parting gift. Give a dowry. When were dowries given?
Marriage.
From the father of a bride to the new husband, right? So it was like to get the family started. Some jokingly, tongue-in-cheek, would say, here, take my daughter. I'll give you two horses and a pig. I think really it was to start the family. But so, parting gifts to the city that's named Dowry. The houses of Exeb, which means lie, okay? The houses of lie shall be a deceitful thing to the kings of Israel. So the great houses that they had in the northern area of Israel were lies. They were trusting in false things, in earthly things, in their riches. Verse 15, I will again bring a conqueror to you, inhabitants of Marishah. The glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. So, Marishah, that means conqueror. So there it is. I will again bring a conqueror to you, inhabitants of conqueror. That's the name of that town. And the glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. Adullam was the place where King David hid from Saul. So in other words, what that is saying right there, the glory of Israel, what is the glory of Israel? That it's been judged and overrun and dispersed. That's the glory he's referring to. That shall come to the hiding places of Judah. So you who are in Judah, you can try to hide to escape the judgment you see upon your northern brothers in Israel. You can try to hide to escape that, but you won't. That judgment is still going to come to you. That's what verse 15 means there. Okay? Everybody with me? Alright. Make yourselves bald and cut off your hair for the children of your delight. Make yourselves as bald as the eagle, for they shall go from you into exile. Yeah, what's this talking about? Well, to cut off your hair was a sign of mourning. You would not cut off your hair, men or women. The men would have longer hair as well. Maybe they'd cut it a little bit, but you know, you see those pictures of Jesus with, you know, shoulder-length hair or whatever. Even though he's got a Caucasian face, you know, that classic picture of Jesus?
Yeah, those blue eyes.
And yeah, the Caucasian. Is there one up there over there somewhere?
Yeah.
So you look at that. Where is it? Oh yeah, right there. See, that's a European facial feature. That's not, Jesus would have looked like a Jew, okay? However, the fact that he has long hair and a beard, that would be historically accurate. He would have long hair and a beard. He wouldn't have a long, narrow European face with blue eyes. That's not what he would have had. Okay?
Because Nazarites didn't shave, right?
Correct. Nazarites didn't shave. They didn't cut their hair or shave. Correct. So, to cut off your hair was a sign of mourning. So that's what this reference is. Make yourselves bald and cut off your hair. In other words, for mourning over the judgment that is coming. For the children of your delight. To show mourning on behalf of your children. You're causing judgment that's going to affect your children. Boy, that would be a problem, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't think anybody wants your sins to be inflicted upon your children. Yikes. And then this is kind of interesting here. Make yourselves as bald as the eagle, for they shall go from you into exile. Your children shall go from you into exile. Your children are going to suffer the consequences of your sinfulness. But what is this reference about as bald as the eagle? Well, the Hebrew word there is not eagle. The Hebrew there is for a large bird. Okay? It can be translated as eagle, but it can also be translated as vulture. And I actually looked it up. I did a quick Google search. A vulture and an eagle are in the same family biologically, you know, in the animal kingdom.
The vulture does not have any.
Right. But if you can picture a vulture, they have no feathers on their head, right? The head of a vulture is bald. The head of an eagle, well, you can think of a bald eagle, but that has feathers. They're just white. So eagles and vultures are related. And so this word could mean either eagle or vulture, but the fact that he says, that Micah says, make yourselves as bald as the eagle, he really means, it should have been translated vulture. Okay, make yourselves as bald as a vulture. Vultures are an ugly bird, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Do we have any around here in Michigan?
Well, especially the turkey vultures.
There are vultures here?
And they can't eat flesh until it's rotting.
Yeah, I know. They're scavengers, aren't they?
Well, yeah.
So they only eat dead things.
Yeah, very dead.
Yeah, that's weird, too.
Well, and the reason why they don't have feathers on there is that they're diving into
carcasses,
meat or whatnot, and if it gets on the feathers, then they get infections. And
okay. Wow. You know a lot about vultures.
Yeah, and if you shoot one in Michigan, I think it's a $500 fine or something.
Really? So they're protected?
Oh, yeah. Same way as seagulls. Seagulls used to be...
Really?
Seagulls, if you shoot a seagull, it used to be $25 a pound.
Wow.
It's a flying rat.
Yeah, I go out to the beach and there's weight, and I say, get away from my sandwich, you seagulls. Get out of here. They just kind of dive bomb you.
Yeah.
I'd like to get rid of some of the seagulls.
Yes. Botulism takes care of them.
Yeah, okay. All right, any questions about that? So that's the end of chapter 1. That's all about the continuing on with the judgment pronunciations, proclamations. Okay, let's get into chapter 2. There's only 13 verses. It won't take that long. Chapter 2. Okay, woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil on their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it, because it is in the power of their hand. So he's continuing on. Remember, chapter delineations are later. All of these books in the Bible, they didn't have chapter numbers when they were written. So this is continuing on from chapter 1, further pronunciation of judgment. So he's pronounced judgment upon them because of their false worship. And then what was the next thing he pronounced judgment on them for? Oh, their trust in their military, their trust in themselves. And now he's pronouncing judgment on them because what do they do at night and then in the morning? They scheme at night. And then in the morning, they perform it. They're scheming and devising wickedness. How can I get away with this or that? Or how can I corrupt that politician or that judge? Or how can I get away with, skimming off the top in the marketplace? Or whatever schemes they were doing. And when the morning dawns, they perform it, which means they are people of authority. They are people of means because they are able to perform it. So this is part of what they're talking about, Mike is talking about again, is the upper class and the leadership. They're the root cause of the problem. Verse 2, they covet fields and seize them, and houses, and take them away. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. So part of their scheming is to take people's property. Now that's a huge big deal back then and today. To steal someone's house and property? Now I remember coming upon this understanding a few Bible studies ago, but through most of human history, the common man did not own land. Okay? In the ancient world, in the medieval world, you worked the land if you were a serf or a farmer or whatever, but you didn't own the land. So coming to America, and it existed in various places before America, but one of the great benefits of America that people wanted to come here, think in our founding years, is that you could own your own land. You could own, a quarter of a square mile, what's that called? A quartile or something? Section. You could order a section, build your house on it, farm it, have your own farm, that you own it.
140 acres.
That is awesome. That you can own your own land. I think that builds pride in a person. That gives you something to pass on as an inheritance. It gives you something that you can work and maintain as your own. It can take care of you for a living. Because the vast majority of human history, the primary vocation has been farming. Okay? So that's a big deal. And God made provision for that in the Old Testament. He told them, when they entered the promised land, when Joshua brought them in across the River Jordan, they were to divide up the land, and they cast lots for which tribes would go where, and then the tribes would cast lots to see which clans would get where, and they would keep doing that until every family got a plot of land. And you'd build a house, and you'd start farming your land, and you'd have grazing for your animals, and you were happy, you were blessed. Because you owned your own land. That's huge. So, to covet somebody else's house and land and oppress a man by taking his inheritance, that's a big deal. Okay? So this is like the fourth category of sinfulness that they're being judged for by Micah. Or by God, but through Micah. Okay? Thus says the Lord. So here it comes. There was all of the problems. Verse 3, therefore thus says the Lord, behold, against this family I am devising disaster, from which you cannot remove your necks. And you shall not walk haughtily, for it will be a time of disaster. What's this footnote say here? Oh, evil. Yes, the Hebrew word is usually translated as evil, which gives us a brief moment to sidetrack a little bit. Can God perform evil? Can God inflict evil? Under our definition of evil, no, he cannot. But can he inflict disaster or trouble upon someone as a form of punishment? Yes. So, when you punish a toddler, do they think mom and dad are being evil? Yes. Oh, you're spanking me, you're so mean, you're mad, or, how can you ground me, or, what? You're taking away my ice cream, you're evil, you're mean. Actually, I've heard that one. You're mean. That's what a lot of toddlers will say, right? And then what you often say is say, look, you don't understand what I'm doing now, but you will later. You can't reason with a toddler, right?
It hurts me more than you.
Yeah, it hurts me more than you. There's another one, right? So, but the point is, from the toddler's viewpoint, it's evil. But from the parent's viewpoint, it's not evil. It's discipline or punishment. That's the case here. So even though that word underneath there, the Hebrew word, can be evil, I like the ESV translators using the word disaster. Because it's really not evil according to God. It would be evil according to us, because God's allowing these disasters to occur to us. Yeah, it's punishment, and it's discipline. It's not evil. So, disaster. And you can't get away from it. You cannot remove your necks. And you shall not walk haughtily, meaning arrogantly, right? For it will be a time of disaster. Same word, disaster twice there. Evil or disaster. In that day they shall take up a taunt song against you and moan bitterly and say, we are utterly ruined. He changes the portion of my people. How he removes it from me. To an apostate he allots our fields. What is all this referring to? Again, this is part of the punishment that's being referenced. This is a reference to being conquered and taken into exile. Okay? Because there's a taunt song. Again, when one nation would conquer another, they would take anyone who's capable and able as a slave. And then while you're being marched away, you'd be taunted. You'd be mocked. It's part of the humiliation, part of the shame. So it's a taunt song against those who are being exiled, and they moan bitterly and say, we are utterly ruined because an apostate, a non-believer, now has my property. Somebody who doesn't believe in Yahweh has taken over my inheritance, my property, my house. Yeah, that's what's going on there. Okay? Comments, questions so far? All right, marching on. Therefore, you will have none to cast the line by lot in the assembly of the Lord. Well, I already mentioned to you, when they entered the promised land, they would keep casting lots, so that's a way to discern God's will of who would be located where, and you will have nobody left in the promised land, in the home country, to occupy your place, to get a plot of land. Nobody left to cast the line by lot. So you'll be left without an inheritance. Ooh, that's a sad thing for them. Yeah?
What is casting the lot? What did they do?
Well, they did a couple of things. One is they would have dice made out of bones, you know, carved flat, you know, like a six-sided die, and they put markings on it, and you could cast that. Another one is like drawing a short straw. So they would have straws, and they'd all be the same length, and there'd be one or more, depending on what you're drawing for, that would be shorter. And so, you know, you draw a straw, and oh, you got the short one. So you win, or you lose, whatever you're drawing for. So that's what casting lots would be. So it was a way, you know, people today say, well, gambling's wrong. Well, I suppose it is, except you could say, well, didn't they gamble in the Bible? By casting lots, although they didn't really gamble. There was a way to say, this is God. Does God do anything by chance?
No.
I mean, there's a side question, and we talked about this at one point in a class at the seminary, and I think I brought it up in a Bible study, too. No, God doesn't do anything by chance.
But it seems like it does.
To us, from our perspective, it seems like it. Yes, that it's just happened by chance, that this happened and that happened. No, from God's standpoint, there are no coincidences. There are good coincidences and bad coincidences. I'm trying to, what is that Seinfeld quote? Good coincidences, there are no coincidences. Anyway, sorry, Seinfeld quote. No, for God, there are no coincidences, there's no chance. He knows everything that's going to happen, and he's got it all planned out. So, if you look at casting lots, throwing the dice or drawing straws for who gets that plot of land versus that plot of land, God's going to make sure that it happens according to his will.
When they cast lots to see who's going to replace Judas, too.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And he prayed ahead of time to make sure.
Exactly. So it's included with prayer. Yeah, that's a good reminder as well. Who should replace Judas? And they probably had three straws, because it was between three, and one was a different length, and whoever draws the short one, that's the one that God chose to replace Judas. You're right. Yeah, that's a good reminder of that, casting lots. Okay. All right. Verse 6. Do not preach, thus they preach. One should not preach of such things. Disgrace will overtake us. Who is saying that and to whom?
To
God is saying it through Micah. Micah is saying that, quoting them, his opponents, or, you know, the leaders of Israel and Judah. He's quoting the leaders of Israel and Judah, what they say to him, Micah, which in effect is what they're saying to God. So, that's why it's in quotes, because Micah is saying, yeah, all those leaders, those wicked, evil, sinful leaders in Samaria and in Jerusalem, they preach to me and say, do not preach, because if you keep preaching that way, then disgrace will overtake us. In other words, if you don't tell us about God's judgment, it won't happen. Right? That's kind of what they're saying. Don't preach of such things because disgrace will not overtake us. So they're disbelieving what Micah is saying. We're not going to be overtaken by judgment, so stop saying that. Well, this kind of sounds like what Paul says in the New Testament about preaching what their itching ears want to hear. Right? You've heard that phrase before? We all kind of want to hear what we want to hear, don't we? Yeah. Should this be said, O house of Jacob? Has the Lord grown impatient? Are these his deeds? Do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly? So this is Micah's answer. Verse 7 is Micah's answer to verse 6. So he's told by the leaders, stop that preaching. We're not going to be judged. And, you know, you keep preaching about doom and gloom and judgment. And Micah responds, should this be said, O house of Jacob? In other words, I'm telling the truth. Don't you want to hear the truth? Don't you want to hear what God has to say to you? Has the Lord grown impatient? You know, God is pretty patient, but eventually his patience runs out. Right? There's a lesson, actually, from this. God is patient with everybody in our sinfulness.
Is preaching just the gospel without referencing anything from the law?
Would this be the same as that?
Yeah, they only want to hear the good things. They don't want to hear about any of those.
Yeah, I think you're right. They only want to hear the good things. Don't tell us any bad things. Don't tell us about having to repent or change our ways or being punished for sin. We don't want to hear that. Yeah, they only want good things.
We don't want the commandments, we just want the blessings.
There you go. That's about true, yes. And then he says, are these his deeds? So Micah is again answering, he's got four questions here. You see, there's four questions. Are these his deeds? Are these God's deeds? No. These are your deeds. And then he says, do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly. This reminds me of something Solomon says. He says, if you chastise a wise man, the wise man will, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact quote, the wise man will take it to heart and change his ways. But a fool won't listen to advice. That's a very broad interpretation of me just kind of vaguely remembering what Solomon says. If you try to correct a fool, he'll reject it. He'll reject your advice, he'll reject it. But if you try to correct or advise a wise man, he'll take it to heart and say, oh yeah, you're right, I should change that, or I should do it that way, or I should stop sinning in that way, or whatever. So, that's what Micah is referencing here. Solomon's already been written by this point, so Micah knows Solomon. Do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly? So, these four questions, Micah is defending his proclamations of judgment. All right? Verse 8. But lately my people have risen up as an enemy. You strip the rich robe from those who pass by trustingly with no thought of war. So my people, Micah says, my own people have become my enemies. What's this footnote say? Returning from war. So you strip the rich robe from those who pass by, travelers who are just passing by, and you rob them. They're passing by, they're not there for any thought of war, they're just traveling through, or traveling by, and you rob them of their riches. The women of my people you drive out from their delightful houses, from their young children you take away my splendor forever. So there again, talk about stealing from people. The women of my people you drive away, so You're pushing them to depart, to escape, to leave, and the young children you're taking away from God's splendor. So that's, by driving someone away, here's how I would apply it to myself and our church. If somebody says something insulting or offensive to a set of parents, and so they leave the church and take their kids with them, the young children are taken away from God's splendor and do not know to learn about God. So that's part of what he's saying here. You're driving away families and you're taking away children from God's splendor. Okay? Verse 10, arise and go, for this is no place to rest because of uncleanness that destroys with a grievous destruction. I could talk about this for a little bit, although I don't want to go too long past an hour, even though we started late. But one of the blessings that God gave to his people when they entered the promised land was that the land would be fruitful and bountiful if they remained faithful to him. So they recognized that faithfulness to God would mean one of God's return blessings to them would be the fruitfulness of the earth. I kind of equate that to America a little bit. I don't know if this is inappropriate or not. Maybe some of my fellow pastors would say, oh, you're going too far, Pastor Measle. But America, throughout our founding days until now, we have been a Christian nation and faithful to God. And what can you say about our land? We've been fruitful. Natural resources, food aplenty, all kinds of natural resources and mines and, you know, metals and energy and all the rest. And so I have to wonder, as our nation is sliding away from God, from Christianity, does that mean God will start removing some of his earthly blessings upon our land? Okay? So that's me just kind of, can I use the word pontificating? I don't know, but they recognize that in the Old Testament, that part of God's blessings for them was upon the land. And so that's what he's talking about this. This is no place to rest because of uncleanness that destroys with a grievous destruction. Your sinfulness is affecting the land. That's the point here. Okay? And then verse 11, if a man should go about and utter wind and lies, saying, I will preach to you of wine and strong drink, he would be the preacher for this people. So in other words, if they had a different prophet, and there were a lot of prophets, by the way. So there were constant prophets who were prophesying to the leaders and to the people about various things. So which ones were decided were authentic and part of God's true prophets, the ones that are preserved for us in the Old Testament, if their prophecies came true, if they spoke the truth of God, and their prophecies came true. So all those many, there's many more false prophets to God's people than there were the true prophets. And the false prophets would preach what you want to hear. Right? So I'll preach to you of wine and strong drink. Yeah, you can go ahead and party. Go ahead and get drunk. There's no problem with that. It's not a big deal. Well, that right there should tell you it was a false preacher, because God said, do not get drunk. He didn't say don't drink, but he said don't get drunk. Okay? So, right there, if a man should go about and utter wind and lies, then that would be the right preacher for you people. You people. We're going to get to the reproaches that we read on Good Friday. Then, okay, we're two chapters into this, out of seven chapters. Now we hear a bit of gospel. In Luther's understanding of this, there's been a whole lot of law. Now there's a little bit of gospel. We're going to go back to law, and then we'll have more gospel. So in the whole minor prophet of the book of Micah, you're going to have these alternating law and prophet as we understand it as Lutherans. Okay. So here's a little bit of gospel. Did I say prophet? I meant gospel. Law and gospel, right? Law and gospel. Okay. So here's a couple of verses of gospel. I will surely assemble all of you, O Jacob. I will gather the remnant of Israel. I will set them together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in its pasture, a noisy multitude of men. He who opens the breach goes up before them. They break through and pass the gate, going out by it. Their king passes on before them, the Lord at their head. This actually is wonderful gospel. Because what is he saying? I will assemble the remnant, the part of you that remains faithful. I will assemble you. And what's the best place for sheep? What's the safest place for sheep? Where would they usually bring them for overnight when they're not out at pasture?
Barn.
Yeah, in the fold. I will gather you who remain faithful to me. I will gather you together, you remnant, and I will set you together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in its pasture, a noisy multitude of men. Kind of a little humorous there. So are sheep generally noisy? I don't know that they are.
Yeah,
are they?
But they're really dumb.
They're really dumb? Sheep are known to be dumb, right? Yeah, okay.
But that's how come I think there's so much reflection of mankind in the scriptures to
sheep.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we're dumb.
Yeah.
We don't act in our own best interest.
Yeah.
We do stupid things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were told not to.
Yeah, well, you're right, right. So yes, God compares us to sheep. Yeah. So God will assemble you together and store you, protect you, like sheep in the fold or like a flock in its pasture. If you're in the flocks in this pasture, who's looking over it? A shepherd. And then what does he say? He who opens the breach goes up before them. He who opens the gate of the fold or opens the breach through the thicket to take them out to pasture or down to the stream. He goes before them, not after them. Before them. And the king passes on before them, Yahweh at their head. See, that's Lord in capital letters, but smaller, right? So you know underneath that is the word Yahweh. So think about this. It is Yahweh himself as your king who goes before you to lead you out of the fold to where you should go. Who's that a reference to? Jesus! There's Jesus right there. This is a reference to Jesus. And frankly, they knew it. The faithful remnant of Judah, when they heard Micah and read it, and read Micah's book, his prophecies, they knew that was a reference to the Messiah. Okay? They recognized this as messianic. All right. And it is. Jesus himself calls himself the Good Shepherd. Right? And he will lead us. Did he lead us? He led us through the death and the grave into eternal life. He will lead all of us through that gateway of death and the grave into eternal life.
What's that picture? Just
well, this picture? Yeah, it's Jesus reading the scroll.
I thought he had a lamb or something.
Yeah, no, he's reading a scroll. It's one of those kind of weird 3D things.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. Okay, so that brings us to the end of chapter 2. Look at that, it's only 5 after 8. So we kind of caught up time a little bit. Questions, comments? Yeah, Rich.
I had a couple of questions. Maybe Greg can answer. I had a pastor years ago. He said that sheep are so dumb that they even need to have help giving birth.
Oh, I have no idea if that's true.
Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, what as a ewe drops the lamb, you're supposed to grab the lamb and swing it.
Okay.
If not, he'll just lay there and die.
Really?
Yeah. And then, you know, have you seen cows take care of calves? Well, sheep don't do that very much.
Actually, when I was on Vicarage in Nebraska, one of the members of the congregation, they were a family of dairy cattle, dairy, and so they came us out when they brought us out when they were calving. And he said, we were in his pickup truck. He said, stay in the truck.
Yeah.
You don't want to be out there because they might get a little aggressive. And then, yes, but we saw a couple of calves being born. And as soon as the calf is born, the mom starts licking it all over and kind of nudging it with her nose and, you know, like getting them to stand up and start moving. And he said, yeah, they lick it in order to kind of stimulate it and get it going. So that's not true with sheep, huh?
Well,
the ewe and the lamb are kind of dumb.
The ewe will eventually, yeah, you're mine. I don't know if there's a bunch of lambs laying there. Well, I'll take the best looking one or what. I didn't have a lot of. I didn't like lambs.
All right. Aren't lambs cute?
Oh yeah.
So, did you have another question, Rich?
Yeah, it is. I will preach to you wine and strong drink. My question is really immaterial, but it's for the discussion. I will preach to you wine and strong drink. Sometimes I feel strong drink was referring to wine in the Bible. Other times I think they maybe distill beverages.
Yes.
To get it stronger.
Yes.
So I looked at the NIV and they said instead of strong drink, they put beer there.
Oh. Yeah, beer's not the right word, but there are multiple different words in Hebrew for wine. And some new wine was not very fermented for very long. So it would only be 1 or 2% alcohol. That's the wine you would give to younger people, to children. It was safe to drink and a very low alcohol. And then as it would ferment more and age more, it would get stronger, it would get better. They did know the difference between better quality wines and cheaper wines. And if you let it go long enough, and maybe it wasn't really a distilled process like we would think of today, but you let some of the liquid evaporate and you let it age longer, it becomes stronger like brandy, which is made out of grapes as well. So the very strongest you would have would be a type of liquor. No, beer is not the right translation at all. But strong drink, or they could have put liquor or brandy or something like that that's related to a wine, a grape-based liquor or alcohol. So it would have that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, yeah, I remember hearing remember when I did the Bible study on wine? That was fun, wasn't it? We got to taste wine. I enjoyed that. Remember that crazy lady on the videos?
Yes.
Some of you remember her. That was crazy. But I remember studying it a little bit there, that there are like 6 or 7 different words for wine in Hebrew, and they have to do with the different qualities and how weak it is versus strong and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's all different characteristics of wine.
The beer translation was from a German interpreter.
Yeah, that's right. That is, you know, that is the holy language after all. Yeah, German. All right, any other questions, comments? All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good night.